It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is now time to welcome back to the program, after far too long an absence, one of the proud Democrat members of the Congress who represents the state of Washington, well, the 9th District anyway, Representative Adam Smith. Congressman, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be on, Lars. Thanks for the chance.
And you're now the dean of Washington's congressional delegation. Congratulations on
that
as well.
Very hard to believe, but yes. I am.
Well, we're always glad to have members of the opposition party on the program because we love naysayers, but I want you to tell me what this is. Governor Jay Inslee and other public officials have declared that Washington State is now a hate-free zone. And when I heard that, I thought, well, that's interesting, but what does it mean?
Yeah, well, actually, it's not, wasn't yesterday. This is something that started 15 years ago. After 9/11, when there was a spike in attacks against Muslims and or people who look like Muslims, I think there was one, particular case where a Sikh, because they wear turbans, was attacked and actually beaten to death mistakenly. And basically, it's trying to stand up to the principle that we shouldn't be bigoted against people. Based on their ethnicity, religion, color, and as you've heard all across the country, there has been a spike in that sort of animosity after this last campaign. So it's just standing up and saying that we won't tolerate that in this state. And if you had heard my remarks, I even said at the end of my remarks, I said, and let's keep in mind that this goes both ways. We need to be respectful of people who voted for Trump in the same way that we expect them to be respectful of us. And that's part of how we have the dialogue moving forward.
Do you think that the folks who didn't vote for Trump, the afterburners, the Hillbots, the, Greensteiners and all, do you think they've been respectful not only of President-elect Trump, but of those who voted for him?
Well, certainly not all of them. But then again, I would ask you the same question. It's always a very aggravating conversation that I would have with conservatives who make the point that you just made. And then I, point out all the instances where Trump supporters, did just truly horrible things to Clinton supporters. And they're like, what are you talking about?
I would ask you, what horrible actions did Trump supporters do to Hillary supporters?
Well, on a couple of occasions, there were people who were physically assaulted and removed from Trump rally. In addition to that,
A country of 300 million.
Just a second. So you're saying that you don't think that when Trump comes out and says that he thinks that we should register all Muslims in this country, that we should ban all Muslims coming into this country.
He didn't say that.
When you have a rally the day or so after the election of the alt-right, whatever you want to call them, where literally you can watch the video and you can hear them saying, let's party like it's 1933. And literally giving the Nazi salute to the speaker, you don't think that means anything?
Well, no, I think it means that every human society has had idiots as long as we've had human society, and every human society will have idiots.
That's all I'm saying.
I know, but when you say we must stand up against the specifics of the hatred of this coming administration, you're not talking, and I would agree with you. There are always going to be nitwits out there on whichever side of the aisle. But what are the specific hatreds coming out of this administration?
Well, when Trump was a candidate for president, he said that he felt we should register all Muslims, and at one point said we should ban any of them coming into the country.
Do you mind if I correct you on that, Congressman? Because I paid attention to exactly what he said. I'm a supporter, and I admit my bias in favor of Trump. But he said we should stop Muslim refugees from coming into this country until we can properly vet them. What's wrong with that?
He first of all has said a whole bunch of different things at different times, and he has actually walked back. But he did use an eye, and in fact, Michael Flynn, who he made his national security advisor, continues to call for these things. Bannon, who he made one of his chief advisors, has not backed down at all in calling for registering Muslims, in calling for banning them from entering this country. Trump has said a lot of
banning
different
those
different times,
but
he has walked back a number of different things.
But here's the thing, Congressman.
Michael Flynn, and I forget Mr. Bannon's first name.
Steve.
They haven't walked back any of it.
When he puts them in
high positions in his administration.
Congressman, you're a member of the Congress. You write the laws. You know that in federal law right now, it's already written into law long before Donald Trump got into running for president, that in immigration decisions, religion is in some cases, required to be taken into account both positively and negatively in some cases. And that was put in the law a long time ago. So when Donald Trump says, when we're going to allow people into the country as refugees, we need to have them properly vetted.
As refugees, absolutely. The argument I have there is I think they already are properly vetted. We have a very lengthy process in place. But if you're talking about just refugees, well, certainly. I mean, that vetting has been in place for a very, very long time. It takes like 2 years to get through the process. And I completely agree that that vetting should take place. The disagreement there is on, you know, whether or not what the vetting we have now is sufficient, if you're talking about refugees. But Bannon and Michael Flynn and even Donald Trump at different times has not limited his remarks to the refugee law.
Well, if he says those coming in, those are either immigrants coming in through the regular process, which has nothing to do with refugees, or refugees coming in, because all the rest of us are either already in or we're already citizens, so we're not coming into the country. So in the context...
Well, no kidding, but if you're just talking about refugees, that's a fairly small number of people compared to the number of immigrants.
It's tens of thousands so far. It's 100,000 during the Obama administration. That's not a small number.
Right. If you compare it to the millions of people who come here as immigrants, it is a much smaller number than if you come out and say, I don't want anyone immigrating this country who's a Muslim. That's different than saying the refugee process has, as you pointed out, a legal standard. You have to qualify.
That includes religion.
Yeah. Well, okay. You've got to be vetted on all manner of different things.
Well, and let me go to the vetting, because
as
you brought that up.
It's an entirely different situation.
Well, Congressman, you said it's a long process. The fact that it's a long process does not necessarily make it a thorough process. You know that. I mean, Congress has a long process for everything, and oftentimes you're not thorough in, you know, a piece of legislation may... Go ahead.
I've read about the refugee process. It ain't just long. It's also very thorough. The background is checked repeatedly on these people.
Congressman, if you were about to emigrate to France, like so many liberals have threatened to do, you know, they could vet you fairly quickly because there's lots of public data to back that up and government data. But if you're coming in from Syria, if you're coming in from Yemen, if you're coming in from most of these countries in the Middle East, especially the ones in a civil war, how do you vet anyone?
It would take a couple of years.
Or it's impossible, right? Are you willing to admit that for some of these people, we cannot vet them?
Well, you can vet them. You can figure out who they are, what they've been doing, who their family is, who their friends are.
How would you do
that? Where they've been at. You do the interviews, and you find it. And if you don't find sufficient information, you don't let them in.
We'll be back in just a moment. Congressman Adam Smith with me now. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I was talking to Representative Adam Smith, who's on the phone with me right now, and he was telling me, without any evidence, 99 point...
Oh, I wasn't telling you anything without any
evidence. Well, let me tell you, 99.99%, I'm quoting you, 99.99% of immigrants come in, they do not commit crimes, they don't commit acts of terrorism. Congressman,
did not commit crimes. They did not commit acts of terrorism.
Right. Now, I want to.
I don't know what the statistic is on crimes like DWI and whatever.
I'll grant all that. But you're saying
acts of terrorism.
Now, let me ask you. I'm going to make an offer to you. I will actually get in my car and drive to Seattle. I want to bring
Make me an offer. Just give me the metaphor.
I want to give you a Christmas present. I'm going to bring you a bag with 10,000 Skittles in it. And I will tell you that 99.99% of them, all but one of them...
But this metaphor doesn't make any difference whatsoever, because if that's a metaphor, we should lock everybody in the country up.
No, because those people are citizens.
99.99% of them are fine.
No, but Congressman, the reason the metaphor... The reason you interrupted the metaphor is that you don't want to hear it, because you don't lock up people already here because they're already citizens. But these people are, say, people knocking at the door of the United States saying, can I come in?
Who are knocking at the door, whether they are refugees or immigrants, statistically commit no more crimes than the people who are already here.
And that brings us back.
In order to keep the Skittles in Portland, you need to make sure that you don't let any immigrants or any refugees.
No, that's not what I said.
And by the way, even if you do that, you're still going to have all the people who are here who commit a heck of a lot of crimes. if refugees and immigrants commit no higher percentage.
And that's where I'm getting to my point. But Congressman, you got to let me finish. If we let in 10,000 refugees and only one of them is a murderous jihadi, then you end up with San Bernardino. And we do have a choice as a country to look at somebody and say no to all of them. No, you can say no to the ones you can't vet. There are many countries where you can find out chapter and verse about people, but not from the Middle East.
That's where we disagree. That's where we strongly disagree.
So I want to ask you, Congressman.
If we have a refugee who is applying, who we cannot vet because we don't know anything about them, we do not let them into the country.
All right, then let me challenge you this way.
Do not pass the vet.
Okay, Congressman, let's get to this. So you have somebody who is a Syrian refugee, and he'd like to be an intern in your office. And you're worried he could pose a security threat. So you say to your staff, call up the Syrian government and see if they'll tell us all about this guy.
No.
What is your staff likely to get?
I don't do that for all my staffers. Look,
you should.
Look, we go back to my original point. If you are a refugee or an immigrant trying to get into this country and they don't have information on you, you don't pass the vet. You don't get in.
I don't believe that's true.
Congressman.
I know you guys have a Congressman, I know that the Democrats have a love-hate relationship with James Comey, the current head of the FBI, but he sat in front of Congress and said, many of these people we cannot vet because we can't get the information. Now, he said that in sworn testimony.
He said it in sworn testimony, not about people who had been let in, but about the Syrian refugees who might be applying.
Right.
James Comey did not say in sworn testimony, we have let in people who we knew nothing about, okay? He said we need to be extraordinarily careful because if we don't know anything about them, we shouldn't let them in, and we don't. It's not a vet. You say, well, I don't know anything about him, but what the hell, we'll take a chance.
And yet... I'd be glad to send your office that list from Jeff Sessions' office of
I have no doubt whatsoever that that has happened, okay? But your argument is with the vetting process, and you're wrong about that. And the only solution to your Skittles analogy is to say, we're not letting any Skittles in. Because, again, 100% guarantees on how people are going to act. Hell, you know, I'm driving through that. Why not driving? I'm riding in a car through downtown Seattle. You know, I'm passing all these guys. I got no guarantee that guy over there isn't going to commit a crime tomorrow.
Here's the difference. The difference is most of the people around you in Seattle on that street are citizens. Almost all of them. Now, there's a small percentage who are illegal aliens, and there are a small percentage who are refugees, and you can't kick people out who are citizens already, but we can decide not to let people in until they're properly vetted, and you don't like that idea.
You keep saying, no, you keep inventing this, I want to let people in, but I want them to be properly vetted, okay? You seem to think that our vetting process, and I'd love to see the document on this, that our vetting process is such that, we don't know anything about this person, don't know their name, but we're going to let them in. That's our vetting process.
Well, we allowed the wife of the San Bernardino terrorist to come into this country. She wasn't vetted well at all.
You do this conservative circular argument, okay, which is if the argument is, look, it is possible, no matter what the vetting process is, that a refugee will do something violent.
Yep.
Okay, if that is the argument, I can't argue with that. It is possible, all right? And the only solution to that is to allow none. Okay, and then you come back to, no, I'm saying I just wanted to be properly vetted. The woman in San Bernardino was vetted and turned into something.
Hold on. She had posted on her Facebook page that she was an ISIS sympathizer. But guess what? The wonderful State Department under that idiot John Kerry didn't bother to look at her Facebook page to say maybe this woman from Pakistan who's marrying the man from San Bernardino has sympathies.
She wasn't a refugee before she came in as a fiance. She posted on Facebook that she was a jihadi.
Yes, yes. She said she was a jihadi. She had ISIS sympathies.
And again, I will say, I'm all in favor of improving the vetting process. But that's not what Donald Trump said during the course of the campaign.
That's your objection to him. And let me ask you about something else. Why does it make sense for President Obama to lock up hundreds of millions of square miles of publicly owned property against oil and gas drilling in the Arctic and the North Atlantic? Why is that a good thing for America?
Because digging up fossil fuels and burning them is frying the planet.
No, it's not. It's what runs our country right now. You're in a car right now powered by some of that fossil fuel.
Indeed. And we are making enormous progress in reducing the amount of fossil fuels that we use by developing alternative sources of energy and also increasing...
Can you tell me this, Congressman?
It does not make sense to try and do that.
Congressman.
And then say, you know what, we're going to... go ahead.
Can you tell me, every bite of food you're going to eat for dinner tonight arrived at your house, first likely on a train, second likely on a big truck, third likely on a little truck, and fourth likely picked up by you or your sweetie in an automobile powered by gasoline. What alternative source do you have to get that food to your plate other than fossil fuels?
Well, I got a couple things. I got a Prius sitting right in front of me.
That runs on gas.
It's a lot.
And electricity from coal burned in Wyoming and Montana.
Dramatically reduce that. No, no. We get, you know this, we get like 65% of our electricity here from hydroelectric.
And 35% comes from
wind.
Fossil. You're buying, I mean,
it
look,
does.
Puget Power
it's
buys a lot of fossil fuel
it's
power.
What I want, they do, but they also bought a lot of alternatives. And the progress that we've made in the last 10 years on reducing our reliance on fossil fuels has been enormous. But if we keep opening them up, if we keep drilling more, put aside the environmental damage of like mountaintop removal for coal and all manner of different other
this
ways.
This is the Arctic Ocean.
And if you just dig up more in the Arctic and in damaged, you know, wilderness areas, putting aside all of that, the more you flood the market with this stuff, the cheaper it becomes and the tougher it is to develop the alternatives that are necessary to stop us going the way of China.
Congressman, I got to go back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout Oregon and Washington on 21 great radio stations. And I've invited to join me in the studio a professor that I've worked with before, not worked for, Peter Lauer. How are you doing?
I am very pleased to be here with you, Lars. And there was nothing else I could do when you asked me to come up because you've been so gracious coming to the university and talking with us. And letting us bring our students over here to watch you make this magic on the radio.
And by the way, you and I probably couldn't be more different politically.
We would hate each other if we didn't like each other.
Exactly. So the reason I called you, the reason I emailed you, is that I wanted to ask you about a meme that has been started by, not in a small place, but a big place, the New York Times, one of the biggest journalism and most prominent journalistic organizations. They swing to the left, in my view. But one of their writers, Jim Rutenberg, wrote a piece in which he said, and I'll tell you how I interpret it, but I want to get your interpretation too. He said, if you're a working journalist and you believe that Donald Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalistic tendencies, that he cozies up with anti-American dictators, and that he would be dangerous with control of the United States nuclear codes, how the heck are you supposed to cover him? Because if you believe all those things, you have to throw the textbook American journalism out that we've been using for the better part of a half century, if not longer, and approach it in a way you've never approached anything else in your career. Now, he goes on. He's essentially saying, when reporters and editors and producers decide Donald Trump is this awful person, and because of that, we're allowed to stop being objective in reporting on him. Would you buy that argument?
Here's the problem, Lars. Right. It's going to be a ghastly time on the radio right now with us because, unfortunately, we're going to, again, probably find something we agree about. Here's the problem. That textbook that he says throw out the window, that textbook, one, should have been thrown out the window when Donald Trump was in diapers, and two, that textbook has always been meaningless if it in fact exists. There is and can be no objectivity in journalism. It's impossible. It can be a goal,
all right,
and it might be a mighty fine goal. But I want to offer to you and your listeners three better goals,
all right,
in my opinion.
Sure.
Remember, I'm just one professor at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, just one, and there are all sorts of different viewpoints down there in Eugene and here at our Turnbull Center in Portland. That's the beauty of academic freedom, not to mention tenure. But here's what I suggest we embrace. We forget about objectivity. We're different. You carry a gun, I carry a pen. You drive a big Pontiac or something, I've got a Volvo,
Ford.
Of course.
Ford.
A Ford, right, a Volvo, and it's an old Volvo. And the upholstery's a little ratty. So we're two very different guys, and what we bring to the radio, if we're doing radio journalism, or whatever else we do as journalists, and I do call you a journalist, I know some of my colleagues don't.
Thank you.
But what we bring is all of that freight, all of that baggage, the good and the bad of our upbringing. So if instead of this lofty, impossible goal objectivity we seek, and I always write it down because it's only three, but sometimes I forget, we seek fairness, we seek clarity, and we seek accuracy. And let's give our audiences the benefit of the doubt of not being 3-watt gurglers and being able to figure out for themselves what's going on and realize that especially today there is this vast, vast world of opportunity with just a keyboard and slaving off some coffee shop's email connection or internet connection, there's this opportunity to get information from everywhere.
If you're inclined and if you know how to do it.
If you're not, then you deserve what you get, sucker.
I don't buy that one because I think that I get paid so that I do this full time. I do it 12 or 13 hours every single day and a lot of weekends where I'd spend
researching. And caffeine probably.
Yeah,
huh?
Researching and caffeine and cigars and American whiskey and everything else. But here's the problem I see with that. When you say fairness and accuracy.
And clarity.
That means that you have to ask all the questions. And I see an awful lot of reporters who only ask the questions that advance a particular point of view. Now, I think from their point of view, if you ask them, do you tilt to the left? They say, no, I'm right down the middle. But from their point of view, they are right down the middle. You know, Vladimir Putin probably thinks he's right down the middle of what the Russians want. And Hillary Clinton clearly thinks she's part of the mainstream, you know, even though she's a multi-millionaire and doesn't at all live the kind of life the rest of us do. But my point is that I don't think we're getting that today, but they will label it that way. And so if you're going to say we're going to do journalism, now mine is opinion journalism and it's labeled that way.
Everybody's is opinion journalism. It's not labeled. Everybody's is opinion journalism by definition. There is no such thing.
Well, I understand
thing.
There's no
Listen,
way.
Lars, there's no newspaper in here. What are you, post-literate here? But if we had a newspaper.
I don't use paper as much as you do.
Oh, it's that soft green side of you. But at any rate, if we had a newspaper here, there would be a lack of objectivity on the front page, no matter what the paper is, based on story choice, based on photo cropping.
The questions you
based
ask
on
and don't
headline
ask.
Size, the questions that you ask and you don't ask. So if instead you do two things. One is you accept the fact that you are not objective and you seek clarity, fairness, and accuracy. And then if you give the audience some sense of empowerment and if you believe your audience might have a few marbles upstairs, then they can seek all sorts of information because the onus should be on us as citizens to get informed using tools like yours, using your multimillion-dollar newsroom, using your 13 hours a day of analysis and all sorts of other stuff. It should not be
but
that something lands on
that.
The doorstep and it's the Bible.
There's a reason that you work for a journalism school that charges for out of state people about $120,000 for 4 years to graduate.
That's because you money grubbers who go down to the legislature and squeeze
the money that we should be getting to educate Oregonians. These two young guys.
We charge them a
from
lot.
Austria. Yes. I know. They get charged a lot. 30 grand a year, right?
Well, these guys 30? Are here on a okay. seminar for
They're
the
on
summer.
Seminar. But if you and were going to
fact,
school
In fact, it
was
your
year.
Tax dollars supported by the U.S. Embassy in Vienna.
But here's the problem with that. You, by the very definition of the institution you work for, understand that to know what questions to ask, because those aren't always implicit in what you're told. If you're told the unemployment rate is 4.8%, do you think that accurately describes the work situation of Americans?
Of course not, because it doesn't accurately describe any of the people who stopped looking for work for just one criterion.
Right. So, but if you're the person...
Isn't this irritating when we agree?
No, but if you're the person sitting at home saying, well, Lars has suggested I need to ask some other questions. What are the questions to ask? You spend 4 years, sometimes 6 years, teaching young people how to ask those questions and how to know where to look for the questions.
Absolutely.
How is the average person who has a job not in this field, a family and other responsibilities?
Because they are not going to those primary sources, Lars. They're not digging through the government records necessarily. They might be. What I'm suggesting they do when I say the onus is on the audience, what I'm suggesting is that they take advantage of the fact that they can read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and then they can read the New York Times editorial page. If there's a bomb that goes off in Pakistan...
There's $1,000 worth of subscriptions right there.
Oh, no, you know you can go around all of that. Every kindergartner knows how to go around those paywalls.
So you're in favor of violation of copyright?
Not me, but you know that it happens. And if there's a bomb that goes off in Pakistan and you want to get a point of view that's close to it, you can look at the English language page of Dawn, the newspaper. And if you don't know about Dawn, you can find it quickly by searching English language newspaper Pakistan, and you can build yourself a reference library on your keyboard so that you can educate yourself if you want to give an hour of the 24
every day. Hold the rest of that
thought,
Professor. I'm talking to Professor Peter Lauer, who's in the midst of endorsing bias on the part of journalists. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. In the studio with me right now is University of Oregon Journalism School Professor Peter Lauer.
Now, Laufer. Remember? That's why I gave you the
card.
That's
right, Laufer.
It's the only thing we seek in this business, right? Get the name right.
Get the name right. So, Professor.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that Americans are getting relatively unbiased coverage of the presidential campaign?
First, let me go back for 1 second to one of the things we talked about earlier, and that is you correctly said we should be seeking. It's a goal, objectivity.
And
I believe that these 3 points I made, fairness, accuracy, clarity, they drive us toward that goal. It's just a goal we can't accommodate. It's impossible because we're human beings. Do I think that
the mainstream media,
the what?
A general
the what did
reference.
You call that?
Let's say, do you want me to list them off? ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, PBS, and
Fox.
The Chicken Noodle News Network,
Fox,
and
Fox. Rush Limbaugh,
the one,
Lars
the
Larson.
One slightly
it's all media.
Okay.
And is there, what was the question?
Is there relatively unbiased coverage of
Absolutely
this presidential race?
Absolutely not.
How do you fix that?
How do you fix that? You don't even attempt to fix that, as I said earlier. You don't attempt to fix that because you accept the fact that those who are out there reporting have their biases and they are included in what you are getting. And you educate the public. You hope the public is educated enough to, one, be able to work through that. And in your own way, you're on the job doing that. You're on the job doing that. And then the other thing you do is you teach how to be media literate and how to look across the media landscape and cherry pick that which will help you understand what's going on, appreciating the fact that there is nothing out there unbiased, Lars.
Except for this. If you say across the media landscape, there's talk radio and there's Fox News, which is even, as we speak, sliding toward the center.
Based on what's-his-name liking the girls.
Well, he's gone now. But even with or without him, they're sliding to the center for commercial reasons. Everybody else is to the left. MSNBC is off the edge of the planet
to the
left.
Some of us think that these things you think are to the left are to the right. Those of us who
you
are
think
proudly
MSNBC
diaper babies, red diaper babies, pardon?
You think MSNBC is too conservative?
It's not too conservative. It's kind of dull at times, and it's kind of humorously attempting to be a counterpoint to Fox and can't get close to it because Fox is so out of hand. What is the catchword? Fair and balanced.
If you were a caller, Professor Laufer,
you'd hang up on me.
No, I wouldn't. I would say, give me an example of their being out of hand. And
give them an example. Just that morning show, which when I'm in a hotel, I'll watch for about 3 minutes before I lose my oatmeal. Because
Good Morning America is so intellectually well-founded.
No, on the contrary, because maybe I'll pick up a book like this book about tortoises, and we can talk about the book I'm writing about the turtle. You'll love this. And I'll come back when the book is published. But Asia is hoovering up our southeastern turtles from Florida,
Louisiana, stealing our turtles?
And Texas. They are stealing our turtles through the same
kind. What are the
Asians
doing with them?
It's
an aphrodisiac.
It's an aphrodisiac.
Of course,
it's traditional Chinese medicine.
An aphrodisiac.
It's food. It's a pet. It's ornaments. They are hoovering this stuff up, and species are being destroyed, and they are being smuggled into Canada, across to Hong Kong, and into the mainland in China and in Vietnam.
You're not suggesting that we should put on a full court press to change the culture of Asia so that they no longer see these turtles as being so special, are you?
Because we'll talk
about
that more
over
a beer
later.
Cultural
appropriation, yeah. Wouldn't it? That sounds like a microaggression to me, Professor.
Yes.
But no, I'm concerned about this because the mainstream media do portray themselves. I mean, every news network portrays itself as being fair.
Sure.
And yet when I watch it, I say, well, you didn't ask this question, and this question would have cast this entire controversy in a different light.
You know, there are two things to say about that. One is, you're right. Whenever we watch anything or read anything, no matter what the point of view of the reporter, the publication, the outlet is, we're going to sit there with a beer in the Lazy Boy and think, you should have asked that. Not just you and me.
I mean
everybody. We're going to say, hey, that's ridiculous. How come you let him get away with that? How come you didn't ask her that?
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. There is that. But the other aspect of this that we have to take into consideration is the speed up going on in this industry. And you know,
the news cycle
and
is tightened up to
those
minutes.
Those guys you used to work with at the TV station would have time to maybe do two or maybe three, if there was a lot going on, stories a day. They'd sit down over a coffee, they'd write the story, they would do a few takes in front of the camera. Now they're tweeting, they're Facebooking, they're blogging, they're doing radio updates on your station to promote the 5 o'clock news, just like the fine fellow who was on earlier talking about the yellow lights. And these guys don't have time to write. They don't have time to think, let alone get that question. Now,
but they always have time to put their political bias in.
Maybe. But let me tell you one thing
I've got one minute left in this segment. I can get
17 things in a minute. We have a terrific book that we put together at the university called Interviewing, the Oregon Way, or the Oregon Method, or something. I'll send a copy to you. You'll love it.
Right.
Each chapter is written by a different professor. I edited it, so I can tell you it's great because I didn't write them. And one of them is written by a friend of the university, and you probably know him or know his work, Charles Jaykel. He was for years on CNN.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who asked the fellow who was going to be senator in Missouri about rape, and the answer was legitimate rape, and that turned the Senate over to the Democrats because he lost.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles, who's a terrific reporter, still kicks himself for not asking follow-up questions then, because he was watching the clock and he had an economy question that was on the docket. So there's a fine reporter doing good work, nothing to do with left or right, Republican or Democrat. He bloody ran out of time, just like we are right now.
That's right. We are close to out of time. I'll tell you my favorite question that doesn't get asked. Everybody asks Trump's daughter, what do you think of the way your father treats women? But nobody asks Chelsea, what do you think of the way your father treats women? You've got the Lars Larson Show. All right, you're thinking that's Chuck Berry. It's not Chuck Berry. It's our friend Ted Nugent, who joins me now, the Motor City Madman. You do pretty good for just sitting down in front of a camera on an old amp and picking up a great-looking guitar and doing a little ode to Chuck Berry. Ted, welcome
Pure
back.
Pure instinct and reverence for the great man. My life quality pivots around all things Chuck Berry, Lars. You know that.
Well, and you knew him.
Yeah, you know, people often wonder why I'm like I am, just a little bit too effervescent, a little bit too uppity and flamboyant and really, really alive. My extreme aliveness confuses people. Let me tell you why. I, Ted Nugent, the Whack Master, the Motor City Madman, Strap Assassin 1, I played bass guitar for Chuck Berry in 1969.
How did you get there?
Because I'm a smart, maneuvering son of a... Tell you what, the Amboy Dukes, we played, 300-plus shows a year, nonstop, from 65 through in the mid-70s. We literally were on the road constantly. It was just awesome. Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea got nothing on me and my band. And so I was always there. I was here, there, everywhere, constantly. And when Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley came through Florida, they were looking for a bass player, so I just jettisoned into the epicenter of all things super groove And I was blessed by God. I mean, to stand next to this guy and perform the rhythm section with these earth-moving classic rock and roll originals. I'm going to tell you, it was an impacting and imprinting time in my life, and I carry it on to this very day.
What'd your bandmates make of that move for you?
Well, we were playing the gigs ourselves, so they thought it was cool. They knew that I deserved it because we always played Chuck Berry stuff. You know, I've been at this a long time. I started playing in Detroit, Lars, in 1955, and it was just shortly after Les Paul electrified the guitar that I was born in 1948. And Chuck Berry, of course, immediately showed us exactly how to maximize the impact of this new electronic frontal instrument instead of the historical rhythm background strumming of the non-electric guitar. So every band, every musician I've ever jammed with, ever collaborated with, ever spent any time with, we all genuflect at the altar of Chuck Berry. There's not a guitar player on the planet that can't play the opening lick to Johnny B. Goode. And if they can't, then they're not a guitar player.
I'm talking to Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman, and we'll talk to him about politics in a moment. He is, of course, the author of a number of books, including Ted White and Blue, The Nugent Manifesto. And we're talking about the passing this past weekend of Chuck Berry. 90 years of age, so many familiar songs, a real talent, and to have lived so long. So, but let me ask you about your playing for him. To go from lead guitar to bass, is that viewed as a step down?
No, I would have been a gun bearer for Mother Teresa, you know what I mean? I can improvise, adapt, and overcome, Lars. You know that.
I know you can.
No, when you have an opportunity, you know, I'm really a spoiled brat when it gets right down to it. I got to bow hunt with Fred Bear. I went around the Indy 500 track in a Roush, 800 horsepower Mustang piloted by Parnelli Jones. I jammed with Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and B.B. King and Eddie Van Halen and Brian May. And I've just jammed with Stevie Ray Vaughan. I've been so blessed to be at the right place at the right time that when you get an opportunity like that, I think I can best answer that question, how did I go from super-duper lead guitar player with the Amboy Dukes to background bass player for Chuck Berry? When I first jammed with B.B. King, you immediately know that you're in the presence of superhuman, super musical monsters. And so you step back. Even the Motor City smart-ass madman, I literally step back in total reverence of being able to play with B.B. King and Chuck Berry, and you want to sponge the moment. I got to tell you, Lars, those experiences were reinforcing my already adamant, militant anti-drug and anti-booze stance, because how could you allow yourself to be in the presence of a Chuck Berry or a B.B. King or any of these great masters of the music and not be at your absolute best awareness, your higher level of awareness, to absorb their genius? And that's what I did. So, I mean, I would have carried his amplifiers, anything to be downwind to Chuck Berry.
Well, you know, Chuck, Ted, that it's really tough to see really great performers out there, and you hear one passes away in his 50s or in his 60s, and you think, gosh, what a loss. And here's Chuck Berry going all the way to 90. I mean, that's so impressive. And you know, he didn't do it by sticking needles in his arm. I mean, I'm sure he enjoyed some beverages and might have even enjoyed smoking a little bit. But the guy obviously took care of himself, or he wouldn't have lasted nine decades.
You know, he did better than average, I'm sure of that. I don't think he ever indulged into the suicidal substance abuse insanity. But being that as it may, I think you have to agree with me, Lars, on the other side of that coin is our dear musical genius, Keith Richards, who, as we speak, is probably doing the breaststroke in some sort of chemical. And though he does have a history, Chuck has a history of being mostly clean and sober, but Keith Richards, who adored Chuck, I mean, he produced that wonderful documentary tribute, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, for Chuck Berry, which you have to witness. Anybody that hasn't seen that has got to see the yin and the yang and the good and the bad and the ugly of us musicians getting together. But Keith Richards embodies he's the poster boy for substance abuse, and the guy can actually still form syllables.
Well, but you know what that's like, Ted. That, I mean, every once in a while you find somebody who's 103 and drinks a fifth of whiskey every day and smokes unfiltered, you know, Marlboro Reds every day, and you say, you see, you can do that. And yeah, well, there are some genetic anomalies out there that manage to do it despite all, but you wonder how long they would have lived if they hadn't done all that.
Well, you know, when Chuck passed, literally, Lars, I was at my buddy's Lone Star Music here in Waco, and we were jamming on some guitars. I'm getting ready for the greatest tour of my life, Ted Nugent, Make America Rock Again 2017. So there's a bit of an electricity in the air everywhere I go right now. So we're jamming, and we're playing some of my classics and some of the old original rock and roll stuff. But we mostly played Chuck Berry music Sunday morning. I mean, maybe that was a church thing for us, and I think it was. But after we had jammed on Chuck Berry music for a few hours, I got in my fighter jet. It's a Dodge Challenger Hellcat, but based on the firepower in the trunk, I think it qualifies as a fighter jet. And I got in my Hellcat, and I started, you know, keeping the adrenaline and the energy of the music alive, feeling pretty good driving this wonderful car. And I get a text from my buddy and said, Chuck Berry died. And you know what? The car went a little faster, and I got a Cheshire grin smirk on my face because he did make it to 90 years old. But I must clarify that when I lost Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Keith Moon and Bon Scott and John Belushi, when I lost all these guys at such a young age, I wasn't heartbroken. I was pissed off because those guys committed suicide, as far as I'm concerned. They knew what all that substance abuse was doing to them. And so I was angry that we lost these geniuses. So I'm quite relieved that we got 90 years out of Chuck Berry. And believe me, Lars, his music is alive and well in all the greatest songs and greatest musicians and the greatest music in the world, because everybody adores and carries on that cadence, that rhythm, that groove, that soulful authority that is Chuck Berry.
Ted Nugent is with me, the Motor City Madman. We'll be back in just a moment. He is the author, of course, of a number of books, including a cookbook, but also Ted White and Blue, the Nugent Manifesto. We'll be back and talk about his possible political future. Can you imagine Kid Rock and Ted Nugent running against each other? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your calls shortly, but Ted Nugent is my guest, the Motor City Madman, a rock and roll legend, obviously virtuoso guitarist, and he did that. You go online and take a look at that little homage that he paid to our friend, Ted's friend, Chuck Berry. But I want to talk politics with you, Ted, if you don't mind. Is this really shaping up that we could see a Ted Nugent, Kid Rock race for the United States Senate?
God help us all, huh? Has it come to this, Lars?
I guess.
Well, you know, I have anywhere between, right now, I think I have 24 million Facebookers, and I go anywhere from 10 million to 36 million Facebookers. So it's not a Ted Nugent hunch. I don't have a hunch about self-evident truth, logic, and common sense in the American way, and where quality of life comes from, a higher level of awareness, accountability, and earning your own way, saving for a rainy day. Hello! So the things that bring me and you and everybody who has a brain and a heart and a conscience a quality of life, it's really alive and well out there. Unfortunately, it's against the law in the government, the media mostly, and academia. And so we've got this triad of anti-Americanism running amok out there, where they just don't avoid it accountability. They abandon it. They refuse to be accountable on a constitutional or a fiscal level. So that being said, if I could run any segment of our government the way we run the Nugent family, there would be no debt. There would be secure borders. There would be a reduction in crime. There would be an increase in law and order. There would be everything that Donald Trump campaigned for. That being said, my friend Lars Larson, yeah, I never committed to running for public office. Somebody asked me if I'd be willing to go back to Michigan and keep the reliably blue state red, because that's what I did for the Trump campaign in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. I know what I'm doing. I represent the working, hard, playing hard Americans who dedicate and sacrifice to be in the asset column. So I told the interviewer that I'd be willing to do anything to get back to the Constitution and rugged individualism and accountability. I'd do anything, including running for Senate in Michigan. And so they put out a press release that Nugent's running for the Senate. So I haven't committed to it, but I will repeat to you, Lars, as I've said before, there's nothing I wouldn't do to make America great again, to make America safe and secure and America again. So, and nothing is off the table at this point.
I mean, Ted, think what could happen. I mean, especially if Republicans had 60 votes and a lot of this 60 vote nonsense that's even coming up in the Gorsuch hearings. But if Donald Trump in the second 2 years of his first term as president, because I expect to see him do two terms as president, if he had 60 or 61 votes in the Senate, he's already moving at rocket speed compared to most politicians, because he's really not a politician. He's a businessman and a deal maker.
Well, just think of the controversial elements. I mean, think, Lars, and I know we've had this discussion before, and it makes you want to get drunk. It's so stupid. So there's a controversy about sanctuary cities. So I would like to meet the human being who thinks that we should provide sanctuary to criminals. The only people that want to provide sanctuary for criminals are criminals. And who doesn't believe that in 2017 our government has absolutely failed America when we do not have secure borders? And the left, the Democrats, look you right in the eye and claim that we don't need secure borders. And the media and the government and academia will not admit that there's a difference between immigration and illegal immigration. They keep claiming that we're anti-immigrant when nobody, write this down, nobody is against immigration.
Nope.
Nobody.
I'm not.
But we're not against banking, but we're against bank robbing. We're against illegal immigration. It's literally Planet of the Apes meets the Cuckoo's Nest, Clockwork, Dayglow, Mad Magazine, Twilight Zone, Goofball City. So my common sense is alive and well, and I thank everybody up in the Great Northwest who frequents my Facebook page, because that logic and goodwill and decency is alive and well across this country, and that you have to go to the website and the Facebook of the author of Wango Tango is a dangerous indicator.
Well, just imagine the jobs that could be available and the way we'd straighten things out, because I think there's something toxic, Ted, about a society that says, well, we have these rules, and John Adams said we were a nation of laws, not a nation of men. We weren't a nation where if you were friends with the king, you could get away with things, and if you weren't, you couldn't. We were a nation of laws, and in theory, the goal we all reach for is that every single person has the law applied to them in the same way. And then lately, in the last couple of decades, it's like, well, except this group gets a pass on the law, and that group gets a pass on the law. And it isn't only Democrats that have done that. It's some Republicans as well who said, well, we have to give a pass. No, we don't. We could say these are the rules of the game. Everybody plays by them. And that way it's a good country. If you start letting some groups get an edge that other groups do not, you stop having a great country.
I'm going to transcribe that and send a copy to Al Not-So-Sharpton and see if he can grasp the dynamic. Yeah, well, ditto. Hello. No kidding. Next. But again, if you listen to the mainstream media, I mean, I end up squinting and furrowing my brow and looking at the TV going, you don't believe the Veterans Administration should take care of our veterans? This is okay with you? You mean to say we're going to send Marines over on the war on terror but not allow them to conduct themselves like Marines? Are you kidding me? So I'm a lucky guy that I hang with the best of the best, and I get to train with the Marines and the Navy SEALs and the Green Berets and Delta Force. And these heroes of the military, their hearts are shattered, Lars, because they, and these are not my words, but I'm more than proud to parrot them. From the mouths of the heroes of the military, they've told me hundreds of times at early retirement ceremonies, at training sessions and at campfires, that Barack Obama was their enemy, not their commander-in-chief. And if that upsets somebody listening right now, then you need to go look in the mirror and study the facts, because that's what the warriors believe. And there might be a few warriors out there that don't believe that, and that's because they've been brainwashed.
Unfortunately true. Ted, no matter what you do a great public service, whether you run for office or not. But I'd love to see Debbie Stabenow replaced. But if you decide to run, we've got your back. If you decide not to run and just do the plain old public service that you've been doing for decades now, we appreciate that, and we support that as well. Thanks so much for the time.
You bet, Liz. God bless the great Northwest, and God bless America, man. Have a great spring, and I'll see you this summer.
Thank you very much. Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman, the author of Ted White and Blue, The Nugent Manifesto, and a number of other great books. If you want to jump in with a phone call, it's 866-439-5277. Follow me on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show, and if you're so inclined, send me an email. They all come right to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and glad to have Juan Williams with me. You know that he spends some time with us every single week, and he comes on the program, and I get a lot of heat from people who say, why do you let that liberal guy on there? And I said, because, one, he's my friend, but two, most importantly, he brings a perspective that I'm not going to bring, and I want people to hear different perspectives and then hear me, you know, duke it out with you, and they can decide, the audience can decide who's won the day or the point that day. Juan, congratulations on the book, by the way. But you mentioned Jesse Jackson, and you speak of him in the book in largely positive terms. And yet he's been, to my mind, kind of a divisive figure and not necessarily an admirable figure in American politics. Tell me why I should think differently.
Well, I don't know that you should think differently. I was interested to hear you say that you thought it was positive, because I think from your conservative position, Lars, what Jesse Jackson has done in terms of shaping the way America is today, and that's what the book is about, you know, kind of comparing America today to America as it was back in 1776 for the Founding Fathers. I think, you know, if you're talking about Martin Luther King, you could see where people would say he was for racial equality and everybody having equal chance in American society to succeed. Jesse Jackson is much more about measuring that success. How many contracts does the Bear Company give to black distributors? How many people are in your schoolroom or in your job site as compared to the percentage in the population? That kind of measure is something that Jackson has brought to American consciousness and American politics, even the number of delegates at your convention. That's a different way of thinking about race. So in the book, it's not that I say he's positive or negative. I just say he's one of the people who has shaped the way that we live in America in 2016. I don't think there's any question about that. It's interesting that President Obama, you're no fan of President Obama, and President Obama is no fan of Jesse Jackson.
No, and that's an interesting point to make. Another figure that you mentioned is Robert Moses, and I've done a fair share of reading over the years on Moses. You give him credit for an awful lot of the way that New York City and the area immediately around New York City looks, because he really did bring some new ideas to the country in terms of transportation and housing and parks. You want to describe Robert Moses?
Oh, sure. You know, I think sometimes this is one of the characters in the book that I think people don't know much about. But if you stop and think about it, Robert Moses, unelected guy, but in charge of city planning for New York, and this is during the 1950s, 40s, 50s, what you see is he creates the idea of the interstate transportation, focus on the highways, get people to go out. And at first, it was for the rich, so the rich could go to their parks and beaches and all that. But as a consequence of that, you get people like Bill Levitt, who creates suburbia outside, because now people are taking those highways to come into the big cities to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this notion of certain areas of cities as preserves versus certain areas that are more industrial versus, of course, the beaches, the recreational areas. That sets the mold for how urban development takes place in a country that has gone from the time of the Founding Fathers, when it was like close to 90% of us lived in fairly rural or even farm communities, to a place today where 80% of us live in urban areas. Tremendous transition, mostly took place during the last century, the 20th century. And again, it's part of the way we live now that would be totally alien to the Founding Fathers. They just didn't think that we would ever be so concentrated in terms of our population.
Let me ask you about one of the things that he did. As I recall it, that Moses ran the Triborough Bridge Authority, or at least had access to the money. And the money that was coming in from that was gigantic by the day's standards. And he used a lot of that control of that flow of cash to be able to make these things happen. Today, we have a system that's so tied up in public hearings and this and that and the other thing. Do you think you could ever see another Robert Moses who'd be so transformational in today's process-driven kind of government agencies that we see around America today?
Well, I guess it's possible because sometimes things get so confused and people do things in small committees and you see some city council bill passed and you think, who's behind that? How'd that happen? And Moses was totally working behind closed doors. I mean, he was the guy, he was a city planner, commissioner of the New York City Bridge and Tunnel Authority, not a high-profile job. If you know, the papers don't cover that kind of thing on a regular basis. But this is a guy that could redirect public funds, Lars. That's why he was able to build these parkways and bridges. He built, like, the Verrazano Bridge in New York, the Whitestone, Throgsnick. I could go on. So he built so many things. He even built, you know, I think you're familiar with Lincoln Center or the UN headquarters.
Or Jones Beach.
The 64 World's Fair. His hand touched so many things. He stopped the Dodgers from building a new stadium in Brooklyn. That's why the Dodgers are in Los Angeles. It's incredible. And yet he was doing this largely undetected because the papers didn't cover him as a government functionary. This guy in charge of, as I said, you know, city planning and commission. He was more powerful than the politicians, but he wasn't known.
Let's take another person that you write about who's not as well known, perhaps, although maybe a bit more as people watch news out of New York City, is Bill Bratton and his importance to answering security concerns for a big city, for America's biggest city.
Well, you know, this is the one character in the book I keep getting people say to me, why is Bill Bratton in your book? How could Bill Bratton merit inclusion in a book, you know, with Ronald Reagan, Ed Meese, Billy Graham? And I said, you don't understand. When it comes to surveillance, when it comes to the way that we are policed as a people, Bill Bratton is a giant. There's just no question. He's the one who brought this. It was a theory, an academic theory of broken windows, where you have to police small crimes in order to send the signal that you will not tolerate crime and that bigger crimes are going to be prosecuted aggressively. But with Bratton, what you also see is he brings in CompuStat, which is that you look and see where crimes have been committed in the past and therefore use it to predict where crimes will be committed in the future. And you use cameras and you use all kinds of other kinds of even sound detecting devices to discover where there may be trouble and, again, predict where trouble is going to occur in the future. This is the surveillance that we live with today in America, where, you know, I say in the book, Lars, when I drive, I have to watch out for red light cameras. I know that there are certain cameras that just take a picture of my license tag in case a crime is committed, and then they want to check who went through that intersection at a certain time. When I go to work, I know I have to have a badge to get through the turnstile downstairs. I have to have another badge with a computer chip in it to get into the suite of offices where I work. Even when I leave my home, I've got an alarm on my home. I know the beeping sound when the door opens or a window opens. That's just totally different. The founding fathers would have found this intolerable. They did not want a surveillance state where the government would be able to track Lars Larson on his way to work or his way home or wherever he's going.
See, I think the technology would have thrown them, but once they became aware of it, do you think fundamentally they would have had a philosophical objection to observing things that happen out in the public? Because remember, when you lived in a small village in those days, I have a feeling that when somebody saw General Washington leave his property in Virginia, that people would take note of it. Say, yeah, I saw General Washington go by. Juan Williams with me. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you. And my friend, Juan Williams, and people are surprised when I say that because they say, he's a lefty. I said, yeah, but I enjoy discussing things with him because he gets me thinking. He's authored most recently We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who've Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. When we left off, you were bemoaning the fact that sometimes we find that there are female generals in our military who are drummed out because they get involved in sexual behavior. And in the cases I'm most familiar with, one of them actually was serving at a base just a couple of hundred miles from where I'm standing right now. She was drummed out because she got involved in sexual behavior with one of her subordinates. And you thought that was terrible. I would think that you, as a good, proud Democrat, would say for people who are in powerful positions to have the opportunity to use that power to obtain sexual favors from subordinates, maybe ignoring the Bill Clinton example, that's not a good thing to have happen, and that it's appropriate to drum somebody like that out of an organization. And yet you said otherwise. What's up with that, Juan?
No, actually, I agree with you. If it's a matter of a subordinate, I don't think there's any question you can't have that. Even if it's a matter of both parties, you know, willingly involving, I think it undermines discipline and authority inside the military. So I would not approve of that. No, I'm talking about people who are discovered to be involved in gay behavior, you know, maybe outside of the military, not with one of their subordinates, Lars, who were then drummed out of the military. And what we're talking about here is a chapter on how the lives of women have changed so radically. I mean, obviously, there were no women at the Constitutional Convention. Women couldn't vote even after the Constitution was passed. We're not even 100 years since women got the right to vote in this country. But today we have not only women in the military, but half of the workforce, and we know sexual harassment is a huge issue today. And again, nothing that the Founding Fathers were ever familiar with, Lars.
No, let's talk about President Reagan and Ed Meese. These are two of my heroes. And you speak admiringly of them in We the People and about how they brought America back to a strict constructionist view of what the Constitution says this country should be.
Absolutely. In fact, I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. You were busy with that wonderful new granddaughter, but I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday talking about how President Obama has nominated Merrick Garland to replace Justice Scalia, and that everybody gets all caught up in, oh, are they going to have hearings? Are they going to have meetings? You know, what's going to happen? I say, you know, in some ways we lose the historical context in which what's key here is the fact that Scalia was really the person put forward by President Reagan and then his chief political counselor, Ed Meese, subsequently the Attorney General, as someone who would read the constitutional as it was originally intended and not extended into giving rights to people that the Founding Fathers had no idea about.
Exactly.
And here I'm talking about gays that we were just discussing, for example, even in terms of abortion rights. So what you get is not only do you get Scalia, you get people like Clarence Thomas, you get people who remember the huge fuss over Bork, the Bork hearings. You get people like Justice Alito. You get all of these folks coming out of that moment when President Reagan and Ed Meese said, we are tired of liberal justices like Brennan, like Thurgood Marshall, like Chief Justice Earl Warren, who are creating a more activist judge who reads the Constitution as a living document to be amended, changed, flexible, bent in the ways that they see. So to me, Ed Meese, especially Ed Meese, as a guiding hand for President Reagan, really has transformed the nation's judiciary. And you've got to stop and say, we are a different place than we would be if Ed Meese and Ronald Reagan hadn't come along.
Well, see, and that's the concern I have, Juan, just to depart a bit from the book, but it relates back to what you've written about. And that is, we have four members of the court right now who reliably vote liberal. And it doesn't seem to matter what the Constitution says. They side on the side that is liberals. Now, I understand liberals might say, well, you have those four now who will vote conservative, but that's not always true. I mean, even I read a piece recently by a young lady who used to work for Justice Scalia, who wrote about the fact that she's a hardcore left-wing lawyer who now works in Hollywood in the entertainment business, and she was left-wing then. But she said she once wrote him a rough draft of an opinion for a case they were working on, as a clerk for him. And he said, no, you're not supposed to write what you think I would like politically. We stick to the Constitution. And I admire that. And I guess I just wish we could see more of that from the other four, that they would say occasionally, you know, my liberal tendency would have me vote yes on this, but I have to vote no because that's what the Constitution requires. And I don't think we see that enough.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, listen, I am one who understands as a black person that, you know what, the Constitution didn't even see black people as fully human and certainly didn't give us the right to vote or rights and the like. So I understand. I mean, there have been amendments to the Constitution to create change. But again, I think that is a matter of the political structure. So the question is, do you want, you know, in the words of Justice Scalia at one point, do you want some unelected judge making decisions for the whole society? So I think it's healthy when you have people come back to our founding document, to the Constitution, and say, what is right, what is wrong? You know, Thomas Jefferson, who had such a hand in the Declaration of Independence, was of a mind that, you know, you can't make any law that fits for all time. People do go through different changes. Times change, circumstances change, the economy changes. But you've got to always rely on the Constitution, on the law. Without that, then what do we have? I think we get to anarchy. So I think that what President Reagan and what Ed Meese did was to say, we've got to always stay in touch with that Constitution. We've got to go back to what it really, the spirit of it, if not literal meaning.
Let's talk a bit about Chief Justice Warren and Thurgood Marshall. Do you think that they would be happy with where America has come today? Because they were right in the middle of the fight over treating children equally, so that black kids and brown kids and white kids could all go to the same school and be treated equally. But today we have a society where that literally says you have to be given special treatment if you are a part of a racial minority, if you're a person of color, because, you know, cities and counties and even the federal government grant contracts that can only be won by people based on skin color. Do you think they'd be happy with the result?
I think I think Thurgood Marshall would be, because I think Thurgood Marshall was all about the idea that you could have, for example, government set-asides and contracts intended to deal with past discrimination or remedy to make sure that, you know, you had minorities brought into the contracts or the economic lifeblood that's created by government opportunity and government money. But I don't think that I know for a fact that you get people like Justice Thomas, also black, who would say no special kind of set-asides or treatment for people who are minorities. Everybody has to compete on the same level playing field. And in the book, Lars, in We the People, what I say is, you know, if you go back to Martin Luther King Jr. and his great speech, the March on Washington, 1963, he is honoring the founding fathers and talking about all men are created equal, you know, liberty, justice, freedom, all those things. He says, we just want equal rights.
The book is called We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who've Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. Its author is Juan Williams. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to welcome to the program freelance writer and the man who curates Nat Geo's book talk, Simon Worrell. Mr. Worrell, thanks a lot for joining us from the other side of the world.
My pleasure. Real pleasure to be with you all.
Well, here's what I've been interested in talking to you about. There's been a dispute or a disagreement for decades among scientists about how it was that Neanderthals went away, and those of us who now populate the Earth in the 7 billions or so managed to outdo them. And you've interviewed some of the researchers who've looked into this, and they think they have a working theory as to how that happened. Why don't we start with why Neanderthals on paper might have been a superior species at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a conundrum, we'll talk about it later a bit more. New radiocarbon DNA dating has really altered our picture of this. So basically, the Neanderthals are our closest cousins. You know, we all know a few people who look a bit like them. Stocky, short, you know, receding brow, muscular, a bit hairy. But they were in Europe for 200,000 years before Homo sapiens moved from Africa steadily out of Africa up into Europe and the rest of the world. And it was long thought that the most likely reason that they disappeared was a catastrophic climate event, the eruption of a volcano in Italy 39,000 years ago. And that spewed vast amounts, like volcanoes these days, of ash and cloud and seriously would have altered the climate. So that was one dominant theory. Of course, your question alludes to the fact that they've been there for 200,000 years. They've adapted. They hunted. They had rudimentary tools, rudimentary weapons. They fitted well into that place. Indeed, their eye sockets were slightly larger than Homo sapiens because it seems as though they adapted to that dim northern light. So the question was always, why would they disappear and not us?
What were the going theories, or what have been the predominant theories until the one we're about to talk about came along?
Well, there were a number, but the most likely, as I said, was the eruption of this volcano in Italy 39,000 years ago that covered the earth with ash and blocked out the sun and led to climate change. There was also a theory that it was the beginning, that when the Neanderthals disappeared, it's the beginning of another ice age. So you would have had ice, cold conditions, increasingly cold conditions, pushing down from the north and pushing the Neanderthals down south. And those were the two most likely theories.
But in fact, that would have made sense that because Neanderthal was physically larger, that even though he was hairy, if he was physically larger, you notice that when peoples have lived in a place like the Inuit in the northern part of Alaska or northern Canada, they tend to be short, stocky people who don't have as much skin exposed to the elements and perhaps don't take as much energy to operate a person as a rather large individual like Neanderthal. But you've talked to some researchers who believe that there's another rather novel theory about Homo sapiens cooperating with animals.
Yes, absolutely. And the person I interviewed for that book talk that you referred to, and it can still be found on National Geographic's website, is a fascinating lady, a retired professor of anthropology at Penn State University called Pat Shipman. And she wrote a book called The Invaders, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction. And her theory, she'd done a lot of research over many, many years, and you could say that it all kicked off with the discovery of these enormous mammoth, woolly mammoth graveyards in Eastern Europe and Central Asia in the sort of 90s, serious excavation began. And what you had was they became known as mammoth megasites. And what you have there is basically a vast boneyard. I mean, I have not visited, and I wish I had, and will one day, I hope. But I've seen a lot of photographs, one particular at Berelek in Siberia. It's just a huge, huge boneyard, these enormous woolly mammoth bones, piles and piles of them. And these sites appear, with the dating that's been done, about 40,000 years ago. We know that. So something happened 40,000 years ago that meant that hunting became much more efficient on a bigger scale and was sort of centralized so that these creatures were clearly driven towards these sites, brought back to these sites, but you couldn't bring them far because they weigh many, many tons, like elephants.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this sort of centralized, more efficient hunting. And, for instance, at Berelek in Siberia, 160 of these tusked Goliaths were found. There were also found bones of what she calls wolf dogs. And here comes the theory. Pat Shipman's theory, and I have to stress, it's a theory at the moment because we haven't got enough archaeological fossil evidence of large amounts of wolf dog bones. Some have been found. And her theory was that around this time, and we do know that the dog was domesticated roughly around that time, human beings got into a sort of symbiotic cooperation with these wolf dogs. Now, it's important to stress they're neither wolves nor dogs. They're a hybrid creature from the tests that have been done.
And does her theory assume that this was done accidentally at first and then perhaps deliberately after that, that Homo sapiens might have deliberately tried to domesticate wolves to become a hunting companion, or that it was done in some other fashion?
It's really hard to know the answer to that question. We probably never will. It might have simply started with humans very efficiently killing woolly mammoths with no dogs, and then the dogs come and scavenge, and the humans make friends with the wolf dogs, and then gradually they become more domesticated. But what Pat Shipman believes, and several other experts believe happened, is that around this time, human beings did domesticate these wolf dogs, and that meant that they had a hunting pack. And that meant, it's not easy to hunt and kill a woolly mammoth. It's a very, very big, a very dangerous animal. If you've got a pack, and Neanderthals, and this is one of the key things as well, were only able to kill things. They didn't have sort of long-distance weapons, so they had to get up really close and personal, and that was dangerous. They probably couldn't kill a lot. Many escaped. Put wolf dogs, a pack of dogs, into the equation, like foxhounds, and you've got a creature, a pack of creatures that can chase down, tire out, exhaust, corral the woolly mammoth, followed by humans, who would then close in for the kill using these more long-distance weapons.
I'm talking to Simon Worrell. Mr. Worrell, we're going to take a break for a second. We'll be right back. Simon Worrell curates Book Talk for Nat Geo. He's a freelance writer, and I'm speaking to him about a theory only at this point, that human beings, Homo sapiens, may have predominated over the Neanderthals because they figured out how to both use better tools and how they figured out how to cooperate with wolf dogs. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. And if you want to get in an email or a phone call, it's 866-439-5277. Emails, go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can follow on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow and on Facebook @TheLarsLarsonShow. It's my great pleasure to be speaking with Simon Worrell, who curates Book Talk for Nat Geo, and also has written about Pat Shipman's theory that human beings, Homo sapiens, cooperated with not dogs and not wolves, but wolf-dog hybrids to become the superior hunter, and in doing that, managed to displace Neanderthals that had been in that part of Europe for a couple of 100,000 years. So how is it then that the Neanderthals would have reacted to this, just slowly been pushed out of those hunting grounds by the superior numbers of Homo sapiens?
Yes, that would be the theory. In other words, that there was a competition for resources, not just for woolly mammoth, although they obviously provide many meals for many people for many, many months, but for other animals as well, that both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens were hunting, be it deer, be it oryx, the primitive oxen. And so you gradually got this window of time where they would have both been competing for the same resources, but because human beings, that's the theory, had domesticated these wolf dogs and were using them as hunting packs, they could kill much more efficiently, and that would have driven out, reduced the supply of meat to Neanderthals. And over a period of time, it's now estimated, and this is another really interesting thing, a lot of this, it's important to stress, from, you know, cutting edge new, we're finding out so much that we thought we're finding out so much that we didn't know about these issues through new radiocarbon dating techniques, DNA dating techniques. And one of the things that's happened is that the extinction date for Neanderthals has now been pushed back to about 39,000 to 40,000 years ago. But more importantly, the extinction period has been greatly narrowed. It used to stand at 5 to 10,000 years. Now it's narrowed down, the experts believe, to a mere, I say mere, in geological time, it is mere, 2,000 years. So you get this combination of events. It could have been all of them, probably was. You had the volcano 39,000 years ago. You had an ice age beginning. Around the same time, humans appear to have been domesticating wolf dogs. 30,000 years ago, roughly, you get also the, 39 to 40,000 years, these mammoth megasites start popping up. And so it seems that, you know, Neanderthals were effectively outcompeted for resources over that 2,000-year period.
Let me ask you about this. You mentioned, I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that Homo sapiens were actually in some ways an inferior animal, if you want to look at it that way. Neanderthal have at least at the same size or a slightly larger brain pan than Homo sapiens do, or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. They have roughly the same brain size, but they were very well adapted, as you've alluded.
They were large. They were strong.
Large, strong. We were adapted to the African savanna. A different kind of climate. But one theory, that thing about the eye sockets, which have been discovered to be much larger, believed to be adapted to northern light. And it seems that a lot of their brain power went to sort of scanning and navigating and sort of negotiating the physical geography, which left less brain power than humans had available for other tasks, like building superior tools, or language, or the raising of children. One of the interesting things is Neanderthal samples of Neanderthal children teeth show that children grew up really fast. You know, this wasn't a world in which you could have a long, protracted childhood. And human beings clearly took a lot longer to come to adulthood and had a long childhood, which is characteristic of us now. So you also had this sort of, Neanderthals, you know, lived fast and died early, and human beings developed more slowly, had other skills, but the basic physiognomy was similar, and certainly the brain pan was similar, but it seems the brain was dominantly used for different things.
Well, and you wonder about that. When Neanderthal, would you imagine, does her theory, does Pat Shipman's theory include the idea that Neanderthal would have observed Homo sapiens, would have been adjacent to them, or sharing the same space for some period of time, for a couple of thousand years? What do you suppose the reaction was, and why they didn't adapt to the same kinds of methods that the Homo sapiens were using? That is, you know, domesticate some dogs and get their cooperation in bringing down food.
Great question. She doesn't go into it. We can only assume that the, you know, Homo sapiens knew how to do that, as they knew how to use more long-distance weapons, and proved superior hunters as a result. But it's certainly true that Neanderthals and humans interacted for a period of a couple of thousand years and indeed had sex, interbred, 40,000 years ago. And we know that because all human beings, non-African human beings, have, you and I included, me probably even more, that's what my wife says, 1 to 6% of Neanderthal DNA.
And yet, with all of that, they didn't simply meld into one people out of that, both the interbreeding and sharing the space. But one line went away, and the other line survived.
That's right, and I think we are talking about superior brain power, ability to form social groups, language, superior weapon skills, and this key element. It's now believed the domestication of wolf dogs, which made them basically king of the hill. You know, they took over. They took over, as we see, you know, the competition in all life, the survival of the fittest. So what we're talking about here, I think, again, is a survival of the fittest story. Humans came into that space. Neanderthals were well adapted for it initially, but then were pushed out, you could say. Homo sapiens was an invasive species, and we see numerous examples in our world today of the success of invasive species, be they fish or plants, and these days the problems that they cause us.
Mr. Worrell, it's a pleasure to have you on. We'd love to have you back sometime.
I'd love to be back, too.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a great pleasure to have with me Stuart Taylor Jr., who's the author of a number of books, but this time a co-authoring with Casey Johnson, Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. Mr. Taylor, there's a case we covered in my neck of the woods at the University of Oregon that involved a group of football players. There was, as usual in these cases, a party. There were people who'd gone willingly to it. There was a young woman who had gone with some men. She became intoxicated. She became sexually she engaged in sex of one kind or another with several of the men, and then went off with them willingly to an apartment. She then said that she was raped. She spent the night, woke up the next morning, and apparently told the police she had sex again with the man that she would later accuse of raping her. And then she left. And in fact, she didn't report it. It was a family member who became aware of it, reported it. The local district attorney looked at the case and said, look, we do not have the elements here to form a rape charge and to take this to the grand jury or to trial, and they simply dismissed it. The university then took it up and said, okay, we're going to have a hearing. And the hearing, and I want you to describe how these typically go at universities, not that case in particular, but they decided that these three young men should be, you know, kicked out of the university and taken off the athletic teams that they were part of. Is that the kind of picture that we're starting to see on American college campuses, and is that an example of, say, the way this problem happens?
There have been several cases that sound almost exactly like that. The one you mentioned in Oregon, there's one almost exactly like that at the University of Minnesota, where their football team got, a lot of them got suspended or kicked out. Some of the cases, the famous cases at Baylor, seem to have that characteristic, i.e. what appears to be consensual sex with drunken women by a group of men. And let's, you know, this is pretty ugly conduct by the men, right?
Absolutely.
But it's not a crime if she was, you know, conscious and if she was willing. And there are a fair number of cases like that, and the universities tend to treat them as though they were real rapes. The typical case is a one-on-one case, not a group case, but there are group cases, and there have also been some group cases that were real rapes. Vanderbilt, there was such a case we talk about it in our book, where the woman was genuinely passed out and was carried to a dorm room by a group of football players who had sex with her in succession, and one of them was filming it, which is how, and you know, they're being criminally prosecuted. When there's a real rape of that kind, the answer is criminal prosecution, not to have some university put on a kangaroo court.
But how is it that the universities don't see that putting somebody in front of a campus court where there is not the presumption of innocence, there isn't a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, there isn't even necessarily an opportunity, and I want you to speak to this, to cross-examine your accuser, but that real-life consequences are being brought down in the form of punishments, how is it that this isn't being challenged in the courts as a violation of one's due process rights?
Well, that is what's happening. I mean, the procedures in these courts, campus courts, and I could elaborate, you know, are really shamefully biased. They're rigged. They're designed, and to some extent under orders of the Obama administration, the procedures are rigged to presume guilt and to try and get people punished, even if the balance of the evidence suggests that they did nothing wrong, or at least nothing criminal. And so why do they do it? They do it, I think, in part, often when people react in a fanatical way, there's some germ of a good reason for it. And the germ here is, many years ago, campuses tend to sweep real rapes under the rug when they happen on campus. They don't want to get the reputation as the rape school. And in decades past, police were not particularly there. They tended to be kind of cynical about rape allegations. They took real victims and treated them badly. So there was a reason why people wanted the colleges themselves to do something about this. Unfortunately, it's been a wild overreaction, and the campuses have not only proved, the colleges have not only proved completely incompetent to bring to do a fact finding of this kind in a responsible way that leads to an accurate result. They're ideologically biased. The colleges are run by a bunch of sick puppies who are very biased against males and in favor of females, and that bias kind of loads the whole process.
I'm talking to Stuart Taylor Jr., who's the co-author of Rape Panic. You've looked at a couple of dozen of these cases. How often does the university's process end up contaminating or even ruining any opportunity to do a criminal prosecution, if one were possible?
Quite often. Oh, to ruin a criminal prosecution.
By the local authorities.
I've never known it to mess up a criminal prosecution. What does happen is that women who, who perhaps were real victims, who should have gone to the police, if the idea is to put the rapist out of commission by locking him up, are channeled by the colleges saying, "Oh, don't go to the police. They'll be mean to you. We'll be nice to you. You know, you'll have to be cross-examined by some nasty defense lawyer if you go to the police. Come to us. There won't be any cross-examination. We'll, we know the guys are guilty. We'll take care of that. We'll get him kicked out for you."
Does that also open up the door for things like the Rolling Stone story that involved Virginia Tech, where a Rolling Stone reporter encountered somebody who said, "Well, I've been raped, I've been assaulted, it happened this way," and then a huge story is done, a lot of damage is done on campus to both social organizations like fraternities and to the campus itself, and yet no good came of it. If anything, a lot of careers were ruined, and people's lives could have been ruined as well.
Yeah, that was a complete fraud, that case, and it points to the dishonorable and dishonest role often played by the media, the mass media, in these cases. This case, Sabrina Erdely was the name of the author. She wrote for Rolling Stone. She searched around the country, went from campus to try and find a really outrageous rape case that she could portray as typical of what goes on campus every day. And she didn't really find any. So she did come across a woman who had made up a wild and crazy and completely implausible story for reasons that have something to do with her own psychological problems of having been gang raped on broken glass after breaking a tabletop by 7 to 9 fraternity brothers at a particular fraternity at the University of Virginia. She made this story up in the hope of getting sympathy, and especially from a guy she had a crush on. Well, the media and the bureaucrats at the University of Virginia just, and Rolling Stone, of course, they all just lapped this up. It was, if you read her description of what happened, I think most people would say, "Wait a minute, this doesn't really sound very realistic." But to the media, it sounded just fine, and it was treated with great credulity by virtually all the major publications in the country until it fell apart because it was a bunch of lies. Now, one little rare exception to the bad role by the media in this case was a Washington Post reporter actually helped debunk this story and prove its inaccuracy. But most of the media never apologized.
His most recent book is called "Rape Panic: The Attack on Due Process at American Universities." It is authored by Casey Johnson and my guest Stuart Taylor Jr. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your emails. Talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow us on Twitter, Lars Larson Show, on Facebook, The Lars Larson Show, and we'll be right back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show on Compass Media. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a great pleasure to have with me Stuart Taylor Jr., who describes himself as occasionally practicing law, but mostly just writing fascinating books like the most recent one, Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. So you've told us that there's a situation that people are being told that there's one woman in five on American college campuses will be raped, something that would scare the daylights out of moms and dads who send their kids off to college, hoping to get a good education, but thinking, "My daughter may be one of those one in five," that the statistics do not bear it out, that the experience doesn't bear it out. And we just finished talking about Rolling Stone, which could have done a story that would be, almost a good prologue to your book, saying we looked all over American college campuses and couldn't find a situation like this till we ran into this fake story. Let me ask you how we go about fixing this. You've also described the campuses as perhaps overcompensating to make up for past bad acts or past bad behavior when the college didn't take real rape cases seriously. But how do we dial this back to where we respond appropriately to the sexual assaults that do happen and don't have kangaroo courts that kick people out without considering their constitutional rights to due process?
Well, it could begin with the Trump administration. There's a lot the Trump administration could do. They couldn't really fix the problem, but they could certainly make things better. And I'm not a particular supporter of Trump, but in, this is one area where everything the Obama administration did, just about everything on the campus sex front, campus rape front, was bad. And just wiping it all off the books would be good. And this isn't legislation we're talking about. They did it by bureaucratic tyranny, by issuing orders to the campuses claiming that they were interpreting Title IX, the sex discrimination statute, but they weren't really interpreting Title IX. They were making stuff up and pretending that it was based on Title IX. And so getting rid of all of that federal overlay would be good. And there are some bad laws that states have adopted, particularly deep red state, deep blue states like California and New York, that that adopt guilt-presuming procedures. The way they define, for example, sexual assault would encompass most voluntary sex. And so then it becomes just arbitrary. But it needs a much deeper solution than that, because this, the attitude and the culture of presuming everyone accused of a sex offense to be guilty, is woven into the fabric of the universities now, the leadership, the bureaucrats, the sex bureaucrats, the professors, a lot of them, and even a lot of the students have been propagandized to the point where they believe this. And so getting back to a balance where we go after real rapists and not after everyone whose date is unhappy afterwards is a real challenge for the country. And, of course, we don't want to overcorrect again and get to the point where women have no recourse. But I think the best approach the colleges should take, first, the Trump administration should also strike out against anti-male sex discrimination, and a lot of these cases involve that. But, you know, we need to have, I think channeling these cases back to police and prosecutors is the best way to go. In an ideal world, maybe the campuses would have a role in punishing people accused of sex crimes, but in the world we live in, they've demonstrated that they're not fit to do that, and that there isn't any way to improve on police and prosecutors in this area.
Well, for instance, if a case has been taken to the police have forwarded it to the local prosecutor or DA, and they have looked at it and said the evidence isn't there. And usually those can't, those kinds of details can't be made public because of the very nature of the accusation. It's bad for both the person who says I was victimized, and it's bad for the person who's accused of doing it. If the DA decides we're not going to prosecute this, we don't have a case. If that's handed back to the university, should the university do anything with a case like that?
Well, what they should certainly do from the start is, in terms of the way they treat women who come to the university officials and say, I've been sexually molested or raped or whatever, they should treat them with kindness for purposes of how they relate to the woman. They should give them the benefit of the doubt that they're telling the truth. There should be rape crisis centers. There should be medical attention. There should be psychological attention. There should be counseling, all of that. Where the line is being drawn in the wrong place now is when you get down to identifying, usually it's easy to identify, usually a woman knows the guy she's accusing. When you get down to the question of, okay, what do we do about him? I think maybe if it's a non-criminal accusation, such as sexual harassment, which is not a crime, there's a role for the universities. But when you get to actual criminal allegations, they should be handled by the criminal authorities, and the universities should stay out. Of course, after the criminal authorities have done their job, and then if the guy gets, say, indicted, the university can suspend him, and if he gets convicted, they can certainly kick him out. But kicking somebody out with the brand of a rapist on him, based on the kinds of kangaroo court structures they have now, is doing more harm than good.
What about these codes that some of the universities have come up with that require affirmative consent for each and every act? And I mean, every time I hear about one of these, I wonder, how does this work in practice? A young man and a young woman meet at a party. They've each had a couple of beers. And the young man says, may I kiss you? And, you know, it's almost like taking us back 100 years. And the young woman says, why, certainly kiss me, but, you know, don't put your hands on me. And I mean, how are those things problematic as well as being kind of unenforceable and unworkable?
Yes, and this is something that a lot of colleges, hundreds I think now, have adopted on their own just because of the ideologue factor. And there are a couple of states, I mentioned New York and California and also Connecticut, and I think might be Illinois, have adopted this as a matter of law, but only for college students, not for, say, members of the state legislature. And it is. I mean, people used to do parodies about this sort of thing on Saturday Night Live, but now it's very serious. You know, may I touch your hand? May I give you a kiss? May I do this? May I do that? And unless there's a may I, or at least a very, you know, very clear body language, at every single step of, let's say, the call it the escalation of a sexual encounter, the woman, usually, can always say, well, yes, I said he could do this, but I didn't say he could do that. And the guy will say, well, she sure acted like I could do that, but under the, you know, under this so-called affirmative consent law, there's no such thing as safe sex, at least if you're the guy. You can always be treated as a rapist if the woman later on decides that she wants that to happen.
Should those codes be thrown out then?
They should, for sure. You know, the laws of the states that define rape and sexual assault used to be too restrictive. It used to be the woman had to struggle and scream and fight, and that was too much of a burden to put on the victim.
Mr. Taylor, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The book is called Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.